We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Audacy put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Audacy. Visit ads.audacy.com.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Dusty.
You're going to have to muscle up, big guy, to get it out there.
And friends.
That kangaroo stole my ball.
This is a PGA Championship Week edition of Dusty and Friends.
Brought to you by Persimmon Country Club. Join Zerton Sprague June 6th for a day on the course. Secure your tee time now at 1080thefan.com.
Dusty and Friends on 1080 The Fan.
Hour number two on Dusty and Friends. The Trailblazers sitting sixth, the best odds for the NBA draft lottery tonight. Where they sit, where they end up landing, it's going to determine several years in the future for this franchise. And I'm very happy to bring on our friend today is a guy that you've seen the ups, downs, everywhere in between of this Blazers franchise. He is Oregon Sports Hall of Famer, one of the few contributors in the Oregon Sports Hall of Fame, Dwight Janes, joining us. How you doing, Dwight?
I'm doing well. I'm very excited today to be one of Dusty's friends. I think that's an honor. I'm sure you don't have many friends, and so I'm just happy to be here and be one of them.
You know, one of the things that you have been the entire time that I've known you is a smartass, so I'm glad that that's not
right.
Changing ever.
That's my stock and trade. It's what I do best.
You know, one of the things that I want to do here and that we've been doing, and I love this part of it, is tell the story of the personalities and the people in our area that we've come to know so well. And you're a unique one because you're a guy that you're born and bred. You're an Oregonian through and through, not just Oregonian. You're a Portlander through and through.
Yeah, that's true. Really is. I was only away from here a couple of years to go to school down in Eugene. That only lasted a couple of years. When I was a journalism major, and I didn't like that major because I could never get any classes. There were a zillion journalism majors down there and not enough classes for all of them, and I kept getting locked out of these classes. So to hell with it, I'm going to go back to Portland State. I'm going to play ball, which I wasn't good enough to do at Oregon, and they still had baseball at that time at Oregon. So I come back to Portland State. I'm going to play there. They had baseball at Portland State in those days too. So anyway, I was going to play. I was out for fall baseball, and the head coach there, Roy Love, who became athletic director at some point, came to me and said, hey, I know you've had a lot of success coaching young kids and Babe Ruth and American Legion and everything. I need a coach for the JV team. And I said, well, geez, Roy, I kind of thought I was going to play this year. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. I'll give you a grenade. I'll give you salary every month, pre-registration, which was the kicker, and something else that I don't even remember.
No more locked out of classes there.
He had me pre-registration because finally I was going to get the classes I wanted. So I said, I just retired as a player. So I coached the JVs there for 3 years while I was going to school. And actually, I was younger than some of the guys I was coaching. But it was a lot of fun, and it got me back to Portland. I was always going to be a high school baseball coach. And,
really?
And yeah, I got to my final year of college, and surveyed the landscape of what teaching was like and saw the kind of declining of discipline in the schools, lack of funding for sports and all those things that were going on at that time. And I said, you know, I don't think I want in on this. So I got out of college and I sold real estate for a year. It was such a roller coaster ride, Dusty. Top salesman in the company 1 month, and the next month sold nothing. And I thought, I can't live this way. This is not me. Yeah. I can't do this. So I took a job. Well, first of all, I grew up as a kid. I was bat boy, clubhouse boy, press box boy, ran the scoreboard, did the PA, and actually did some radio play-by-play for the Portland Beavers. And
no
so
way.
I knew writers, and I knew Ken Wheeler at the Journal at the time.
Yeah.
I said, Wheels, I call him up. I said, Wheels, I always wanted to be a sports writer. I have no credentials whatsoever. High school paper. I didn't do anything at Oregon. And he said, well, we hire part-timers. You know, we'll probably hire you. Come down and get an interview with Bill Moeffler, the executive sports editor. Long story short, I did that. I got hired for $2.25 an hour.
The big bucks.
Answer the phones, take prep scores on the phone. And to make ends meet at the time, a friend of mine had a small appliance repair shop. I went to work for him repairing appliances.
Really?
I knew nothing about that, but he taught me. I repaired electric shavers, lamps, all kinds of goofy hedge trimmers, all this stuff. Yeah, I can't do it anymore, so don't bother calling me. But anyway, that's what I did. And so I started working at the Journal. And in those days, the full-time guys would go on vacation in the summer, and they would let the kids go out and cover events. I covered Pop Warner. They used to have what was called a Rosebud game where the CYO All-Stars played the Pop Warner All-Stars. I covered that game.
See, why don't they do stuff like that anymore?
Oh, it's too bad. It really is. I covered youth swimming. They used to call them the Ing sports. Bowling, skiing, curling, all this stuff. Lawn bowling. They were the Ing sports. I covered all those. I covered rodeo. I covered everything getting started. But they finally had an opening as the prep editor. And the sports editor at the time, George Passero, called me at home and said, hey, buddy, which is what he always said because he couldn't remember our names. Hey, buddy, how about coming down? I got something I got to talk to you about. So I go downtown and talk to George, and he offered me a job. And I took that, and I worked my way up covering just about everything before I finally got the Blazer beat in, I think it was 84 or something like that.
Wow.
Became a columnist in the 90s. I've probably been to, I would say, 9 or 10 NBA finals. I think 8 Super Bowls. I think 8 or 9 World Series. I never bothered to count them all up. Several All-Star games. The best thing was they let me go to spring training every year. This was the days where the Oregonian was flush, by the way.
Yeah.
Whatever you wanted to do. You just, they'd let you do it.
Is that probably the biggest change that we've seen, like, in sports journalism?
Oh,
Is that willingness to send you guys to different places?
Absolutely.
And how valuable was that for you guys as far as networking, getting to know people from across the country and people from all the other sports?
It was incredible. It was incredible. And I eventually became the columnist. I don't know what I would have done as a columnist without all those contacts I made.
Right.
I still have all those guys I talked to that are still around. You know, it's like even like Pete Vesey has been retired for years. Peter and I talk. He was at my house for a barbecue 2 summers ago. It's just amazing all the friends you make. Sam Smith, a guy that wrote Jordan Rules, a good friend of mine. All these guys you meet over the years that help you out along the way.
Right.
I was inexperienced. I didn't have a big journalism school background, but I got a lot of help. A lot of people at the Oregon Journal and then the Oregonian helped me through my career and helped me become whatever it was I was. I don't know if they were ever proud of me or not, but anyway, I got to where I wanted to go eventually. And really, I covered everything I wanted to cover, Dusty. I never covered an Indy 500. Didn't want to. I never covered the Masters because I wasn't playing golf at the time. I had no idea what I was missing. Plus, we had one of the great golf writers in the country, Bob Robinson, who went every year, and I wasn't going to bump Robbie out of a chance to go to the Masters. So I didn't go to that. Kentucky Derby, didn't care. So I didn't go to those.
Yeah, but everything you wanted to, you got to go.
A lot of times, like the spring training, a week in Florida, a week in Arizona. That was for the sunshine. Yeah, I enjoyed the baseball, but come on, I was trying to get out of here and get to the sun.
Well, what was the coolest one that you were able to go to? The one that you just sit there and you're like, that I saw history. It was awesome.
There were a few of those. The first World Series I covered was 1979. The Pittsburgh Pirates and the Baltimore Orioles. The Pirates were the We Are Family, Willie Stargell Pirates, came back from a 3-1 deficit to beat the Orioles in Baltimore.
Wow.
I sat in the dugout in Baltimore, and there was a former Portland Beaver catcher, Harry Seyfried, in the dugout too. Right before the game, I mean, it was like half hour before the game, we're sitting in the dugout, fans are going crazy, and the president's coming in, bomb-sniffing dogs sniffing out the where the president's going to sit. And I'm sitting there, and tears started running down. I mean, this is where I wanted to be. I thought I was going to do it as a player. Then I thought, well, maybe someday I'll be a manager. But here I am, an ink-stained wretch in the dugout covering a World Series, and I'm thinking, how did I ever get here? How did I get here? And then I'll tell you, I had two other landmark things I covered. I covered Cal Ripken's streak where he broke Lou Gehrig's record.
Yeah.
You talk about tears. I saw grown men, hard-bitten old-timers, crying in the press box as that man did his lap.
On the horse, yeah.
Around, well, he was running on that one. Horse was later. But the kid in the outfield dropped his hat on the field. Ripken runs all the way back, gets it, and throws it back up to the kid. And it's like all of this fuss for a guy. All he did was show up for work every single day.
Every day.
Who couldn't relate to that? You know, it was just a phenomenal experience. He hit a home run in the game. It so happened my son was with me on that trip.
Oh, cool.
He was standing, no ticket. He was standing outside for hours waiting to buy a scalp ticket. I'd given him $100 to buy a ticket. Finally, he went back to the hotel, put his Grateful Dead t-shirt on, and had a sign that said, "I need a miracle." And some guy comes up and says, "Dead end, huh?" He goes, "Yeah. Well, here's a ticket."
You're kidding.
No. And he sat in the left field fan, right in the left field bleachers about 20 feet away from where Ripken's home run landed.
Wait, so your son's a genius is what you're saying.
Because, and what was the impetus of putting on the Grateful Dead shirt? Was it just like he was like, that's...
It was for good luck, and he figured another deadhead's going to spot that, and I might get lucky. And it worked out that way. And I'll never forget it. He came running up. They have an open press box in Baltimore. He came running up. He's waving at me, and he's like, I got in. And it was an incredible experience. There's no way I can relate what an experience it was to see that guy do this.
Yeah.
One more thing I did that was amazing. Yeah. I was at the Tyson Holyfield fight.
No.
When an ear got bitten.
Oh.
I was there.
Okay.
You talk about an incredible evening.
So when you're sitting as media for that?
Yeah.
Now, what is the reaction in media row at that time? Because like that is probably one of those moments where if social media would have existed then, the internet would have exploded. Yeah. At that time, all that you guys had was you guys were looking down media row at each other.
And the thing was, right away when it happened, you couldn't really tell what happened. You just saw Holyfield jump like he was stung by a bee or something, you know? And it's like, what happened? What was this? And we're not like sitting ringside. We're back off, you know, the ring a little ways. It was a Don King production. He didn't care about the media. He never had to.
He didn't need you guys.
Yeah, he didn't have to. He had Ali in his pocket, Tyson in his pocket, so it didn't matter. So anyway, it was just incredible. Fans were going crazy.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they eventually, you know what they did? They stopped the fight and everything and awarded it to Holyfield, who was winning the fight by a pretty good margin. And so we're waiting afterwards for a news conference that really kind of didn't ever happen. And
really?
It was just strange. But the aftermath after the fight was incredible. The fight was in MGM Grand Gardens, and we're all staying at the MGM Grand. That was the media hotel. And there was a riot in the casino and in the hotel. And so many things happened. They had, for a while, they had to shut down the actual casino. It was shut down for an hour.
Whoa.
And it cost them $1 million to shut it down for an hour. And this was in the old days. And there were gunshots.
Yeah.
Okay. The next day in the paper, Las Vegas Courier Journal had a 1-inch story on page 9. People mistook champagne corks popping for gunshots last night at the MGM Grand. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, sure. Sure, yeah. We did.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Very, very, very similar sounds way, there. Yeah.
No way I would have ever.
That's incredible.
But anyway, and we go outside. I was with a friend. We went outside to get something to eat that night. And there was yellow crime scene tape and cops behind their cars with their guns drawn. That's
really?
How bad it was. And people running around, all kinds of chaos. I'll never know what happened. And I think you can ask Rop about it. I think Rop was at that fight, too.
Rop was there. He has a story of hiding behind slot machines.
Yeah, it was craziness. And the classic part of the whole story was I didn't hear for months later There was a whole group of NBA players there.
Yeah.
A couple of famous ones, actually, all in a group. And the story goes, now these stories sometimes are apocryphal. The story goes that the NBA office received a videotape of these players pillaging the tables as they ran out of the casino, scooping chips and dollars off the tables and getting out. And the demand was, we want our money back and more, or this goes public. So the NBA wrote a little check, and then in return, the players got a little bill from the NBA
really?
To pay back what they stole, supposedly.
Wow.
And I know that group that was there, and I'm not going to name names, but it didn't surprise me. Let's just put it that way. It did not surprise me. But they were raiding the table. It was an incredible night.
We have Dwight Janes here with us. Let's start. You mentioned the NBA. Let's talk about the NBA. And when you started covering the Portland Trailblazers, the lottery is tonight. You've been through, boy, every up and down, because your first year would have been 1984 on the Blazers beat. A pretty memorable draft that year. Let's start there, Dwight. Dwight Janes is in studio with us, Dusty and Friends on the Fan.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is a PGA Championship Week edition of Dusty and Friends.
Brought to you by Persimmon Country Club.
On 1080 The Fan.
Dwight Janes is our guest, five-time Oregon Sports Writer of the Year, and the first person ever to win Oregon Sports Writer of the Year and the Sportscaster of the Year. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
I'm not the only one, but I was the first one.
You were the first one to do it. You got on the Trailblazers beat in 1984. That would
just a dime.
My goodness. We talk about the draft hiccups that this franchise has had. That would be the year the Blazers drafted Sam Bowie over Michael Jordan.
Yeah, now, you know, the first thing we have to do is kind of take you back to what the world was like in 84. You know, this is the time where if you didn't have a big center, you weren't going to win an NBA title.
Yeah.
That was the conventional wisdom. You had to have the guy in the middle, and it had to be a really good guy or you weren't going to win. And that's the conventional wisdom. Now, given that, the player they wanted in the draft was Hakeem Olajuwon.
Yeah.
And in those days, they had a coin flip between the Eastern and Western conferences to see who got the first pick. They lost the coin flip. That was the first thing that went wrong for them. So Houston got Hakeem. And then there's Jordan, and then there's Sam. And Sam Bowie, people don't realize, you know, before the injury started, he was a heck of a player.
Yeah.
Go back and look at his rookie year. He was terrific. He could really run, and he could shoot. He was like one of the first centers who could make a three. And a good player, an honest player who worked hard, and a good guy. But
he wasn't Michael Jordan.
Obviously. Yeah, and it didn't take long to figure that out.
Yeah.
You know, Michael ended up winning a lot of games. And the other thing is Portland had Clyde.
Yeah.
They had Clyde Drexler. So it's like, okay, Jordan's going to be a star. Well, we got a star. You just didn't know that Jordan was going to be a super-duper star and maybe the best player of all time. That's what you didn't know. And
yeah.
That was hard to project. It was hard to say that a guard was going to be that kind of player because it just really hadn't happened before.
No, because the conventional wisdom, as you said, you got to have a big, you have to have a center. Well, Michael Jordan kind of changed that, you know,
changed the
way the game is played on a lot of levels. The other thing about that year, though, that's crazy is we often forget, like, Sam Bowie is one guy. The other guy they drafted that year was Jerome Kersey.
Yeah.
And Jerome, you know, he became such a valuable piece to what the Blazers built. And that team in 84 was pretty damn good when you have Clyde, Sam Bowie, was it Jim Paxson, Michael Thompson was on that team, mm-hmm. Kiki Vandeweghe, Darnell Valentine, wasn't he on that team as well?
Yeah.
And then you add, you know, young Jerome to that mix as well. The Blazers were kind of, they were really well built in that year.
They were. And you know, a forgotten man in Blazer history was that general manager, Stu Inman. And if you asked everybody who's a Blazer fan now, who was Stu Inman, they wouldn't know. They couldn't pick his picture out of a lineup. But he was terrific, and he put those teams together. And he did a great job. He had a great feel for the job. He missed some. Of course he did. They all do. Every GM misses some.
How long was he there for? How long was he making picks for? Because there was a run where you went, you know, whether it was 83, you get Clyde, then 84, you get Bowie and Jerome. But Jerome is like the steal of that one. 85 was Terry Porter. Mm-hmm. And then 86, you go and you get Kevin Duckworth as well. Like, I mean, you're hitting.
They traded Walter Berry.
Boom, 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 boom.
For Kevin Duckworth.
I mean, those were.
That was an amazing deal.
That's 3 years in a row where you're making, 4 years in a row, you're making incredible acquisitions.
Yeah, that's a home run every year, really. Good starting players who made all-star teams, you know, other than Jerome never made an all-star team. Terry did and Duck did twice. And he had an incredible run, and one of the best GMs this team ever had.
Well, and I think back, and you mentioned Terry making the All-Star game, and I went back and I was looking up some of those teams a while ago, and that 89 team that made the finals, Terry Porter was the highest paid player on that team, making $2.1 million that year.
Yeah.
I mean, $2.1 million, and that was the highest paid player on the Blazers.
It was a different era. We're talking about an era here where Michael Thompson would beg me to come over and watch WrestleMania at my house because I was going to pay for it, and he didn't want to pay for it.
You're kidding me.
And he said, be sure to have – it was some sort of Bahamian beer he wanted. I'd have a couple bottles of that in the refrigerator. But he would come over and watch WrestleMania, and there'd be a steady scream of – my son's friends in and out of the door to get his autograph. But as long as we got to see WrestleMania, he was cool with it.
Now,
that kind of shows us how different it was covering the team back then, too. Like, you have a player wanting just to come to your house to watch WrestleMania.
Well, here's the thing, though, Mike. In those days, no charters. They didn't fly charter. They went out to the airport just like I did, stood in line. They didn't have big security in those days. But they had to sit there and wait for their flight just like a normal person. Yeah. And it kept them humble, believe me. And I can tell you so many times where just sitting around or being on the plane with them was an opportunity. I can remember Caldwell Jones coming up to me in the locker room. Great guy, the late Caldwell Jones. Fantastic man. He came up to me and he said, hey, guess what? We're going out of Houston Hobby in that Houston trip 2 weeks from now. I said, yeah, so what? Houston Hobby, he says. Houston Hobby, the best chili dogs in the league. I said, Houston Hobby Airport? The chili dogs are unbelievable. So I checked the itinerary. We're leaving Houston Hobby Airport at 7:30 in the morning.
He's getting a chili dog.
We're waiting for the plane. Caldwell says, come on, let's go. I said, come on, it's 7:30 in the morning.
He goes,
no, we're having chili dogs. We go down there, and they're open, and they're selling chili dogs. And it was a pretty good chili dog, I got to tell you. But you did. I mean, people talk about the step back jump shots and Harden and all that. Kiki was shooting those umpteen years ago. Kiki taught my son that shot because my son was small and couldn't get the shot away real easy. But my son, they practiced at the Jewish Community Center, and Jack Ramsey would pull the bleachers down so that members could watch practice.
Oh, you're kidding.
Nowadays, you got to have a freaking signed agreement from the commissioner of the league to get into a practice.
To go in there.
You can't get into a practice.
Yeah.
everybody, the guys that played noon basketball at JCC, they were there watching practice every day. And Jack told me once, oh, yeah, I like spectators at practice because you know what? The guys don't want to be embarrassed in front of, even if it's 20 fans, yeah. They don't want to be embarrassed. They play hard every practice.
Well, it's incredible to think about how accessible the NBA used to be.
Yeah.
Because when my dad coached football up at Lewis and Clark College, mm-hmm. that's where they practiced there
LC,
too.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, when the football team at Lewis and Clark was getting done with their practice, you'd have the Blazers getting done with theirs, and they're sharing a shower yeah. with a bunch of NAIA football players, you know, and these are like the early 90s Blazers. These guys are going to play for championships,
yeah.
and they're sharing the same facilities as an NAIA football team.
But can you imagine those same guys sitting in an airport amongst real people? And believe it or not, nobody bothered him much. It wasn't. Yeah. Nowadays, there'd be a selfie, you know, everybody wanting something from him. In those days, it was just like, you know, some little old lady might go up to Kiki and say, golly, you guys are all kind of tall. Yeah, we are. We're tall. You know, but it was so different.
I mean, I do have a little story just from, this was like 6 years ago when Melo was still on the Knicks. And I was at PDX and I was flying home to see my parents. So I was flying to Newark. And at the gate at PDX was Carmelo Anthony. And I'm a Syracuse grad and I love Melo. So I just like did a triple take. You don't see athletes sitting yeah. at a gate. Yeah. For a regular flight, like a red eye flight. And I talked to him for 2 seconds. I just wanted to say hi. I was a Syracuse grad and he was here for Nike. So he wasn't flying for the team and he was going back to New York. It is so rare to see athletes in that yeah. situation.
You know, when I was at the Tribune, we sponsored the Oregon Sports Awards. We brought them back. It was the yeah. old Hayward banquet. And for the first one, we thought we better get a draw. A spectator draw, somebody that maybe people would want to come see. So we thought of Charles Barkley. And Carrie and I both knew Barkley or know Barkley pretty well. Carrie calls Barkley up and said, would you come up? We don't have a lot of money to spend or anything, but would you help us get this award ceremony off the ground? We're going to honor a lot of high school kids. And Barkley said, sure, I'll come up. The only thing is, though, I can't be in an airport. People kill me in the airport. He said, I can't do that. So we went to Platt Electric, Harvey Platt, who's a great sports fan, a yeah. great supporter of sports. So Harvey, we got to get Barkley up here. He said, you tell Charles he can have the company plane. As long as I can send two employees who are big Barkley fans on that plane with him. Charles said, hell yeah. Get them on, as many as you want, as long as it's just not too many, and it's a private plane. I don't have to be in the airport. So we did. We sent Platt Electric's plane down to Phoenix to pick up Chuck, and he flew back with these fans who just had a great time with him. He regaled them with stories. Charles Barkley goes to Oregon Sports Awards, talks, and stands there after the awards and signs every autograph for every kid who was there.
Now,
it was amazing.
That is so cool on several levels, right? We were talking about that accessibility that you had to athletes and getting to know them personally, yeah. which seems to be gone. There's like a bigger divide than ever between oh, yeah. athletes and in the media now. But then you have Charles saying, yeah, you put some fans on. But how about Harvey Platt doing a solid for two of his employees being like,
I got two
Charles Barkley fans. I want to put them on a plane
yeah.
going down and back just so they can hang out with their hero.
That's the kind of guy Harvey is. He steps up.
And
that was terrific. And he knew we needed Barkley up here. And Charles, I used to do this show called Posting Up on the NBC Sports Network. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get him and I could never get him to answer the phone. So he was up here playing in, it was Brian Grant's charity golf tournament. And so I just went out to the course and said, Charles, I can get a camera here in an hour. Would you do an interview and sit down with me? Sure, have him come out. So I get on the phone, get the camera guy out. We set up something somewhere out on the fairway in the shade. And we did an hour with him.
You're kidding.
And they're calling for him to come in. He has to speak or doing something. I'll be fine. I'll get there in a minute, you know. And we just talked and talked. He tells in the interview how he took money from his agent when he was in college. All this stuff, you know. And throwing throwing the little man through a window in
yeah.
Milwaukee
yeah.
and saying, well, he had it coming. That's okay. So, but it was a great interview and a great guy. And I'll always love Barkley for that. He was always great to me. He was great to Carrie. A couple guys like that. He was that way. And I'll tell you, Carl Malone was always very nice.
Really?
Talking to him. Yeah. very polite, very nice. But there was a certain relationship between Utah and Portland where they played so much in those days,
right,
in the playoffs and everything. I got to know Jerry Sloan very well and his assistant, Phil Johnson, very well. And we would meet them the night before a game. They'd come into Portland and stay at the Marriott, and we'd go down to Champions and have nachos and beers with them the night before a game. That's a great relationship with Jerry Sloan. None of that could happen in these days.
No.
If somebody tells you they know what's going on in the locker room and all that, we can't get anywhere near these guys anymore. And since COVID, you can't even get in the locker room anymore.
And they like it that way. Well, like the organizations, the leagues like it a lot more.
The organization is adamant with their PR guys. They used to be facilitators. Now they're speed bumps. Mm. You know, they keep you from getting to athletes. And it's a shame.
Yeah. We've experienced that here, too.
I'm sure you have. Absolutely. I'm sure you have. It used to be so easy. And sometimes that thing turns around, too. When attendance starts to drop and they start realizing maybe the public doesn't have the affection for these players that they used to have, maybe that'll change.
Dwight Janes is our friend today. We're telling some stories, and you brought up a great one with Michael Thompson in WrestleMania, but there's so many other characters that were brought in, especially in that heyday of how special Portland was in the late 80s, early 90s, when they were making championship runs in those teams with the cast of characters that they had. I want to pick your brain on those guys,
sure.
Especially, you know, a guy that I know you know very well, and I got to know a little bit in Jerome Kersey, who I don't think there's better people than guys like Jerome.
Dusty, one of the best.
He was one of the best. I want to pick your brain on that, but first we got to get Mike with SportsCenter.
This is a PGA Championship Week edition of Dusty and Friends.
Brought to you by Persimmon Country Club.
On 1080 The Fan.
All right, Dwight Janes is our friend today. We're
sharing
stories.
I'm only a friend for a day.
Only today. Today okay. And today only. We go back to being enemies after this, Dwight.
All right, perfect.
Some of the great stories about, you know, the Portland Trailblazers are from, you know, the 70s, 80s, and then those early 90s teams. And, you know, there were special people on those teams. And one of them is Jerome Kersey, who I don't know if there are athletes now that are like Jerome. You know, it wasn't just that Jerome was from a small school and he came from Longwood and, you know, nobody had ever heard of him. And Portland was a big city to him, you know. Yeah. He was so humble and down to earth, even when the successes came too.
He was. And I think everybody was so happy to see him succeed because he worked so hard to make success happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big deal that is overlooked at times. He was not supposed to be that good a player. And he really didn't have the tools to be that good a player, except that he just worked so hard at perfecting what he did. And he's also a guy, statistics in the playoffs, always better than the regular season. Always. Every year, his scoring average, his rebounds, everything better in the playoffs. He played when the times got tough. He was there for him, always. Unlike some of the other guys.
Unlike a lot of guys that we turn and we look at, you know, over the history of the playoff. I mean, look, Chris Paul's a great example of this, and what he's going through right now is that, you know, he can put up decent numbers, but is it helping your team win? And that is where Jerome and kind of there's a buy-in from everybody and kind of knowing their roles on that team very well.
Well, it was a different era. You know, that was still back in the era where team basketball was played, and we're slowly getting back to that in the NBA. If you look at who's winning big now, it's teams who share the ball, teams who are not dominated by one guy hogging the ball all the time.
Miami and Boston.
Actually, all four teams left really
for
are
sure.
kind
yeah,
of playing
they,
just good
they
team
play
basketball.
That way, yeah, for yeah. sure. And it's a little different with Milwaukee because with Middleton out, Giannis had to take a bigger role. And it's no accident. They didn't win either.
For sure.
Because when you try to win in the playoffs with one guy doing all, how many times do we have to see it with Damian Lillard? As good a player as he is, if he has to do it all, he can't do it all.
Right.
They're going to take that away. They're going to double you. They're going to do what happened to Chris Paul in that series where they start trapping him, blitzing him, and they're blitzing dribble handoffs even just to keep the ball out of his hands, fence him in, and just take him away. And it's just it's more and more of a true thing now that you better make sure all your players touch the ball. Part of that's analytics.
Right. Yeah.
I never thought about it, but two or three years ago I saw the stats on it's better to have an average player shooting an open jump shot than to have your best player shooting a contested jump shot. And that's like, that goes against everything the NBA has stood for. Yeah. Just give the ball to so-and-so and let him go. Well, we saw with Brandon Roy, same thing would happen in the playoffs. Sure, he'd take the ball. He could get his own shot. That's the other NBA cliche. Can he get his own shot? Big cliche in the NBA. Well, he can, as long as you're not sending two or three guys at him. And that's what happens. And when you do that all the time, the other players stand in the corner. Maurice Harkless, Alfred Kuminu, they stand in the corner and wait to have the ball passed to them, even though they can't shoot threes anyway, because that's all that's left for them to do.
And when the ball got to them, they'd often step out of bounds,
trying to make their dribble. One of my pet peeves, by the way, guys who step on the sidelines, those sidelines haven't moved in 100 years. Okay?
It happens.
They're always
so
in the
often.
Same spot. Every game, somebody for one team or the other steps on that sideline. It drives me crazy.
They have really big feet, Dwight.
It was mainly Alfred.
I hadn't thought of that.
It was mainly Alfred Kuminu when he was on the Blazers, too.
He was good at it. Yeah. He was also good at hitting the side of the backboard from the corner three.
You know, what you were saying, though, about the what you're saying about the wide-open jumper as opposed to a contested one from your star, it goes back to something I've said is that, you know, anybody that says, like, yeah, so-and-so's a bum, the worst player in the NBA is the best player you have ever played against.
Why? By far.
Because even if you played against, you know, Damian Lillard or, you know, here locally, if you played against Kevin Love or Kyle Singler, those guys got a hell of a lot better when they went to college and then they got to the NBA. These guys are incredible.
Inevitably on Twitter, oh, so-and-so's garbage. He's trash. He's garbage. No, he's not. He's made millions of dollars playing a game that you couldn't come close to playing.
Yeah.
He's not garbage.
Comparatively to his peers, maybe, but no, he's not.
Not even to his peers, though. There's such a fine line with these guys, and so much of it has to do with the way you're used. You see guys, they're not much at one team. They get traded, and the next coach knows how to use them. I mean, Myers Leonard couldn't get off the bench for Terry Stotts. Yeah. He starts for Eric Spoelstra. You know, and starts. He only plays 18 to 20 minutes a game. He's a starting player on one of the best teams in the league, okay? You can't take that away from him.
Yeah.
You know, don't even get me started on the contract thing because people don't understand what happened. They had to give the contracts to keep the cap space. Paul Allen insisted on keeping the cap space. So Turner and Myers, if they didn't pay those guys, they were going to lose that space.
Because there's a salary cap floor.
If you're over the cap, if you say you're $30 million over the cap, you better pay somebody that $30 million, and then you can keep that space for the next guy. But if you don't pay, it comes right back to the cap again. So you can't go over again. You can't go over whenever you want. You just can't do it. You can go over to keep your own players. And then they went out. You think Evan Turner was their first choice that year for a free agent? They paid Evan more than he are. He calls his mom and says, you can't believe what they gave me.
Well, yeah.
They wanted that space. That was Paul Allen being a good owner saying, I'll pay that just to keep the cap space. The problem was, and after that, you can't get a free agent to come here no matter what you pay him.
Well, and that Evan Turner at least was honest. In his opening press conference, I was laughing my ass off because he even said, he goes, the reason I'm here is because they paid me more than anybody else. Nobody else is giving me that money. He's like, that's why I came here.
Right.
And he was just like, well, I mean, and Paul Allen was a good owner.
He was
a good owner.
Yes.
You know, and that's where I want to pick this up on the other side. Where has this thing gone awry? It was a really well-run organization in for several years. And Paul Allen would fire his GMs, but they would always have
a
way.
Went off the rails with Bob Whitsitt, but we can talk about that.
Let's talk about that. Yeah. Dwight James is our friend. This is Dusty and Friends on the Fan.
This is a PGA Championship Week edition of Dusty and Friends.
Brought to you by Persimmon Country Club.
On 1080 The Fan.
All right, we're talking with Dwight James here. He's your friend of the day. We were talking about, you know, those 84 years where that's when you started on the Blazer beat. It was 1984, the Bowie draft. Are we sure it's not the Bowie curse? Are we sure it's not the Dwight curse? Did you curse the Portland Trail Blazers?
Not intentionally, but I might have. Who knows?
All right. I just want to make sure.
I was on hand in 77 when they won that game.
Okay.
I wasn't covering them, but I was at the game right in the sidebar. I had to do a Daryl Dawkins sidebar that game. Yeah. Well, because that was back in the days of Planet Love Drawn and all his fantastic BS that he used to talk about when he wasn't a starter. You know, he was playing behind Caldwell Jones.
Well, at some point you got to make yourself known, and that was it. Apparently,
it was. It helped him.
But this organization, we talk about how they built that championship. Well, the Western Conference champions, and then those NBA Finals teams. Where, I mean, it was year after year of, you know, they hit on Clyde, then they hit on Jerome in the draft, then they hit on Terry, then they hit on. And in '89 alone, they went out and they got Mark Bryant, Drazen Petrovic, and Cliff Robinson, and they traded for Buck Williams that year too.
Yeah.
I mean, it was every single acquisition they made, they hit a home run, and part of that's luck. Right?
Yeah, it is. Right.
But where has this thing gone from? It was a franchise of consistency where, what was it, 21 straight years they made the postseason?
Yeah.
To now we're on, they went in the Jailblazer era, pop back out of it, dip back down and get Dame. Now we're dipping again. Where has the consistency gone with Portland?
I think I'll say they had an extraordinary run. And then, you know, anything is subject to the odds, the percentages, and things like that. When you're up that long, you're going to be down for a while. I think they've had a similar run to just about every other team in the NBA over the last several years, only better because they've made the playoffs 9 years in a row or something like that. And people are mad about that they didn't win a championship. But, you know, who's winning championships in this? It's not set up for the small market teams in bad weather cities to win championships. It's just not. It's pretty much set up for Chicago, Miami,
LA, New York,
Boston. You know, look at who's won.
And then Milwaukee gets a generational talent in Giannis.
Right. Yeah.
And they found a way to do it.
15th or 16th, whatever they picked him. I don't know. But,
you know, one of the things that a lot of people will point to is, you know, Neil Olshey, kind of the Zach Collins trade, and you've long been a defender of Neil.
Well, I defended the Zach Collins trade because Zach was going to be a really good player.
Yeah.
Now I don't know. I still have trouble with this, honestly, Dusty. I don't know if you blame a front office for drafting players that could get injured. Because seriously, if that's the case, there's a lot of blame because Greg Oden was drafted.
Yep.
Brandon Roy was drafted when a lot of people in Seattle told me, man, those knees are not going to last.
A lot of people.
Yeah,
had that.
You heard it. Yeah. And you take Sam Bowie, who had an injury history at Kentucky, and you know, on and on and on. And I don't know if that's, I don't know how to handle that. How do you parcel that out in blame and who gets it? Your team doctors or people who have looked at him? I'm sure he had assurances from his medical staff that this guy was okay because they look at everybody. And so I don't know. But Zach was on his – Zach, because of his temperament, which is a little on the nasty side, I think was going to be a different kind of player and just what they needed. 3-and-D, tough.
That's what everybody said that team wanted or needed.
It is.
I think a lot of what rubbed people the wrong way, and it would have been handled a lot differently or taken in differently by the fan base, is the way that Neil just kind of spoke down to everybody, whether it was media, fans, you know, in the kind of I'm better than you situation. at every turn.
I see where people would think that. And my personal experience with him was not that.
Really?
But I think I was the only media guy in town he talked to. And I think he respected how long I'd been doing it.
Yeah.
And what, you know, when he talked to me, and he would, I think he kind of found out about what I knew and all that and respected that. So I never had trouble getting a hold of him, talking with him. He gave a lot of interviews on TV with me that he didn't do with others. So I had respect for Neil as a man who was doing one of the toughest jobs in sports. And I think people expect perfection out of that job, and they're not going to get it. You just don't hit every time. I thought his pick of Anfernee Simons is an incredible pick. How do you go to, IMG Academy and pick him when, you know, he wasn't even playing against anybody. They didn't even play against good college teams. How do you see that? You know, but he did. And he's made some good picks, good second-round picks. Gary Trent Jr. was a heck of a second-round pick. I don't know. I don't know how to handle that. Obviously, he made mistakes, as they all do. But,
what I like, honestly, is
experience in that job. He had some experience. He'd made the big trade. He knew how to do those things. I worry now, and I like Joe Cronin, always have, respect his intelligence. Very smart guy. But I worry about his ability to pull off one of those big trades when he sits down across the table from one of these GMs who's been doing it a long time.
The one thing that Neil was always great at, in my opinion, was the late first, early second round pick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned Simons. You got Nasir Little also end of the first round.
Yeah.
You know, say what you want about Alan Crabb. He was a good second round pick. Will Barton, second round pick.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was always his strength, was finding the diamond later. It was when you had the earlier picks where you take Myers or Zach higher in the draft in the lottery that didn't hit. Where
I think CJ too was true,
of course. That's kind of where you look at it and you're like, well, okay, maybe up there he wasn't as good as he was finding guys with more value.
I mean, and it's, you're never going to bat 1,000, right?
And we're coming off, you know, look at the GMs before him. I mean, somebody here traded away the possibility for Chris Paul to get Martell Webster. You know, I mean, you look back at that deal. Now, I think part of that was Paul Allen, Seattle kid, Martell Webster, had a great workout, didn't miss a shot. By all accounts, everybody says Martell Webster is the best workout they've ever seen. But come on, it's Martell Webster coming right in out of high school.
There is quite a few whiffs. Sebastian Telfair as well.
Oh, God, that was a horrible pick.
Horrible.
Terrible pick.
All right, Dwight James is with us. We got stories with Dwight continuing on. You can get your text in at 503-250-1080. We'll have your questions with Dwight coming up at 2:30 is when we let you guys unleash on the fan text line and ask all the questions in the world. We've got Dwight James. I wrote this down because you just kind of dropped it and left, but I want to talk about your time with the Portland Beavers.
Yeah, sure.
In the next hour, because I love that we have the hops. I love that we have the pickles here. Mm. I miss AAA baseball.
Me too.
And I wish that at some point we could get big league baseball here. Dwight James is with us. This is Dusty and Friends on the Fan.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.